CBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CB Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. He's at his New York City home for tomorrow's court hearing, where Donald Trump and the world will hear the still-sealed criminal charges against him. ABC's Aaron Katursky is outside the courthouse.
Tomorrow, the former president will become just another criminal defendant on the downtown docket. And yet, he is no ordinary defendant. The Secret Service will deliver him to court to be arrested. Officers could take his mugshot, and though he won't be handcuffed, Trump will have to stand before a judge for arraignment on some 24 charges.
A special counsel has subpoenaed some Secret Service agents who are connected to Mr. Trump's detail. A source says the questions will center on classified materials that Donald Trump had at his Florida home. The White House has several words to say about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signing a bill into law that allows carrying concealed guns without a permit, but the key word from the White House, shameful. This is ABC News. A Virginia teacher shot by a 6-year-old student has filed a $40 million lawsuit against school officials and may face a countersuit.
In her lawsuit, teacher Abby Zwerner says the 6-year-old boy who shot her had a history of random violence and school administrators ignored warning signs. The shooting happened in January in Newport News, Virginia. An attorney for the former principal of the school tells ABC News she's now considering a lawsuit against Zwerner. The attorney claims that before the shooting, a student in Zwerner's class warned that the shooter had a gun and that Zwerner told the student to sit down and be quiet. Zwerner's attorney calls the potential countersuit absurd. Lindsay Watts, ABC News, Washington.
Nearly 90% of Parisians have voted to get rid of rental e-scooters. Paris has about 15,000 of them. Pedestrians complaining they're an eyesore and traffic hazard. The NCAA Men's Basketball Championship underway at the NRG Stadium in Houston. Number 5, San Diego State taking on number 4, UConn. Andy Field, ABC News.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. The National Weather Service says at least 9 tornadoes touched down in southern Wisconsin during Friday's storms. One tornado that traveled between Judah and Albany carved a path about 10 miles long and 350 yards wide. The National Weather Service confirms 8 other tornadoes from Monroe to Jefferson. A crew is in Iowa County today. Former President Donald Trump may be arraigned tomorrow, the same day Wisconsin voters choose their next state Supreme Court justice. Political observers say it may boost Trump supporters to turn out for Dan Kelly.
Every indication is this race is tightening at the end. I don't think both sides would be loading up and unloading their cannons if they didn't think that they had a chance.
Republican strategist Bill McCaution was on Upfront yesterday. In sports, the Bucks beat Philadelphia last night. The Brewers host the Mets today. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The spring election is Tuesday, April 4th. It's being called one of the most important in the country, with candidates for one state Supreme Court seat on the ballot.
Vote. Then tune to your local Civic Media radio station for coverage you won't find anywhere else.
It kicks off at 7 p.m. with a special As Goes Wisconsin.
Then at 8, News Director Terry Bell has results with reporters checking in from around the state.
Election coverage live Tuesday, April 4th, starting at 7 on your local Civic Media radio station, streaming on the Civic Media app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Tuesday is going to be a interesting day. I guess that's one way of putting it. It's going to be a huge day. We can use the huge part of that. All across the nation, not just in New York, where that's going to be the center of things, I think, because you know, obviously you don't have an ex-president indicted and arraigned very often or ever. So this is going to get a lot of the attention, going to suck a lot of the oxygen out of the room. But you know, we've also got the election for Supreme Court and a Senate seat in Wisconsin that could have major implications for that state. And also Chicago, you got the big mayoral coming up. So going to be interesting to see how those play out. But clearly what's going to suck the oxygen out of the room is going to be Trump. And here to share some thoughts on all of that, I've asked my good friend Bill Scheer to come talk with us. Bill's a political writer for the Washington Monthly. You can check out his work there. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
So let's start with Trump. I might as well go there since the Trump show is now back. Ratings, I guess, are fairly high. What are we expecting?
I'm expecting, I think, what everybody else is expecting. You know, a lot of circus, a lot of spectacle, a lot of bloviating. But at the end of the day, you know, he's going to get indicted. We'll see the specifics of the indictment. People will say whether they think it's a strong case or a weak case, depending on their pre-cooked biases. But you know, we can't actually know how well the case is going to go because this is also a precedent. We've never had a former president go on trial like this.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I mean, now I got to think I personally think it's probably going to be a fairly weak case. And the reason I say this is because I don't know that Trump would have been pushing for the indictment to come, you know, and try to set the timeline. I got this feeling they're going to try and push this as fast as they can because they believe this is going to be the weakest of all of the other ones that I think are coming.
I mean, certainly the other ones presumably around the corner are more grave. When you're talking about actually being charged for stealing an election or not handling highly sensitive classified documents. Though you can make an argument that the Stormy Daniels case is about trying to hide money used to win an election by covering up the truth. And if this had come out, I mean, what's weird about the case, of course, is that Stormy Daniels had already gone public about this affair years prior before Trump ever ran for president, but it wasn't widely known. And if she had done a fresh interview, perhaps it would have gotten more coverage. Would that have hurt him with, you know, evangelicals in the run-up to the election? You know, who knows? But that's in that respect, this is why campaign finance money is supposed to be above board, not be hidden. So everybody knows where your money is coming from, what it's being spent on.
Yeah.
So you make the case that it's more serious than it seems at first blush. But the strength of the case, I mean, I just can't know. And it's even hard to know just from the indictment itself, because any allegations to be proven in court and the ability for a former president to get a fair trial will obviously be heavily debated. But part of me has to think if you're the Manhattan DA you wouldn't take it this far unless you felt pretty good about it, because to lose a case like this would be highly embarrassing for you.
No, and this is why my mind goes into this place, because, again, we haven't seen it, and I'm waiting to see it, and I'm waiting to get some of the analysis on it. But in my mind, I'm going, if I'm Trump and I think it's a weak case, I'm going to do just what he did, try and set a time for set the timetable on what I want and to push them in a direction and really kind of hammer on it, so that if you do win it, well, that just makes everything else look like a witch hunt as they've been trying to frame this. Because that seems to be the play. Or do you have a different idea?
Well, I'm at this point not one to presume that Trump thinks all that strategically or logically. You know, it's...
Okay, I do give him too much.
I think he has always been a, you know, maximum narcissist. He does almost everything to maintain his ability to be in the spotlight, but also to be a cult of personality for his most loyal followers. And that requires never apologizing, never conceding, always pushing the boundaries of the law, and assuming that you can always find a way to eventually get away with it through delay and distraction. And intimidation. And obviously these things have gotten him pretty far in life, but there's always the risk that you play that card one too many times, it's going to catch up with you. So I don't know if he's being strategic and thinking that he really has a good hand to play, or if he's just living in the moment like he always does, and this is going to end up being, you know, one risky play too many for him.
Yeah. Any chance the judge puts a gag order on him?
I mean, there's always a chance. I mean, this is all so unprecedented, and I don't know a lot about this judge, what his general attitude is about things, and if he had a certain record, a certain pattern of behavior before this, would it apply in this case? It's all so new and also unusual that kind of stuff, I feel like you just have to wait and see.
Yeah, now, see, I'm of the mindset, if I'm the prosecution and the judge does that, I'm fighting the gag order because I want Trump out there. I want him talking about this all the time. I want him digging his own grave.
Well, look, he is already a very unpopular figure, generally speaking. He may be closer in the presidential trial leads than you and I would like. You know, the last average I saw was Biden 48, Trump 46. That's pretty close. But it's also kind of where he's always been. He's always been around the mid-40s, and that was just barely enough to win in 2016 in a couple of fluky close states. But it wasn't enough for him to hold the House in 2018. It wasn't enough to hold the presidency in 2020, let alone the Senate. And it wasn't enough for the Republicans to have a good midterm in 2022. So on the whole, he's someone who is not terribly popular. The people who have embraced his theories about the 2020 election generally lose in competitive races. So the more he is the face of the Republican Party, is probably not good for the Republican Party. I can't tell you that it's a guarantee he'd lose, but odds are all we have seen is that this is not the best foot forward, the best face for the Republican Party. And so if he is front and center, this trial keeps him front and center. It may help him in the Republican primary, but probably not in the general election.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the way I see it as well. But it's going to be interesting to watch how this plays out, and how media or how public opinion will sway or maybe not. Because right now, what was it, 60% think that it's the right direction on the indictment. We'll see where this takes us. I want to get your thoughts on moving over to Chicago. Because the big issue there, as I understand it, is public education. You've got the Chicago Teachers Union on one side backing Brandon Johnson. You've got Betsy DeVos and that crowd over on the other side backing this Paul Vallis. You've got the Chicago Teachers Union on one side backing Brandon Johnson. You've got Betsy DeVos and that crowd over on the other side backing this Paul Vallis. Any thoughts on the mayoral?
Well, also crime. I mean, we can't discount crime in this election too. I mean, Vallis is endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, and Johnson is endorsed by the Chicago Teachers Union. So these two powerful unions Both highly polarizing. I think neither one really has uniform support in Chicago. And I think probably both candidates are trying to argue that they're not beholden to a particular union and are going to put the interests of the city first and foremost. And from what I can tell, I mean, I'm not on the ground in Chicago, but what polling I've seen is that Ballas has the edge. I think in the endorsements game, Johnson has some high profile progressive endorsements. I think Ballas has a broader swath of endorsements, because he has Patrol Order of Police. He also has Bobby Rush, the Democratic congressman who was a former Black Panther. So there's a wider ideological range there for Ballas. And I think on the money edge, I think Ballas has the edge there too. So if I'm prognosticating, I think Ballas has the edge here, but of course it is close enough. And you can't know if that the youthful base of Johnson, the progressive base of Johnson, are those folks going to show up and outdo what the polls indicated, what the money race might indicate. So it's certainly a too close to call situation. But objectively speaking, I think Ballas has the edge here. And that's probably more to do with the crime issue than the education issue.
Yeah, that was my second. That was where I was going next. You jumped right over top of that. Because I was going to go with the difference between on the education front. Because clearly you've got Ballas, who's going to, I believe, be a charter school kind of privatization kind of guy that I don't think has worked well in a lot of places. But there is the crime issue. You listen to some of the messaging coming out, and you think Chicago's on fire all the time.
Well, and Johnson, here's someone who said, in the wake of George Floyd, that defund the police is not just a slogan; it's an actual political goal. He's walked that back, and this is my point. Johnson seems to recognize that that's not the place you need to be in. Even in a Democratic city like Chicago. And keep in mind, we've had many Democratic mayoral races since George Floyd, and the candidate that's been more closer to the pro-police side of things has generally done better than a candidate that's closer to the defund the police side of things.
Yep.
This is true in Buffalo, in San Francisco, in Minneapolis, in Seattle. We've had in New York City, first and foremost. So Chicago seems to be in that same place. They rather see somebody taking crime seriously than trying to shift funds away from the police, even though, it's Chicago. This is a place where police have not been everybody's best friend in Chicago. So it is a fascinating example. And so I wouldn't go as far as to say that there's a uniform thing about the police there, but it does seem that push comes to shove, a slight majority wants to see the police be funded, not defunded. And even Johnson is trying to calibrate his message to acknowledge that and say, hey, I'm not trying to defund. He said the other day, I won't cut their budget by one penny. But he wants to say he'll be tougher and smarter, that he'll route more resources to mental health issues, have police focus on violent crime. He's hoping to walk the line there. And if he does win, I think this is the key point here. If Johnson does win, I don't think it's a validation of defund the police. It's a validation of Johnson being very nuanced and backing away from that position to say, hey, even if you want to crack down crime, I'm still your guy.
No, I thought the whole defund the police thing was stupid from the beginning. I said from the beginning, I support the police when they're not wrong. We should give them the resources they need so that they can do their jobs, and I support them when they're not wrong. When they're wrong, you got to hold them accountable, and I think that's where everyone should be, I think. This whole idea that we're going to defund and destroy and dismantle, idiotic. Just my thoughts. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Bill Scheer. Bill's a political writer over at The Washington Monthly. We'll get links out on social media. You can check a look at the work that he does. Lastly, I wanted to get your thoughts on what's going on in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin could be a huge... as Wisconsin went in 2011, with all of the Act 10 stuff and all the attacks on labor and on, government in general, this could be a place where we turn some of that around, I think. And this Supreme Court seat might be part of that. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I'm sort of hopeful. Money isn't everything. It's not always the case that the candidate with the most money wins. But in a down ballot race that doesn't always get a lot of attention, money certainly can be a bigger factor. And it's notable that the Democratic candidate, the more progressive candidate, is winning the money race, does have more advertisements on the air. And historically speaking, Republicans have been more focused on these down ballot races than Democrats are. It's been a frustration for some Democrats. You're not investing in the state legislative races. You're not investing in the state judicial races. We're getting our clocks clean cycle after cycle. And now in this race, you've seen Democrats really energized about this. And Republicans seem more conflicted because, yeah, the Trumpers want the election deniers everywhere. You know, they want to take over the judiciaries and try to win these election battles. That's not a uniform position amongst Republicans. There's definitely it may not be a majority faction, but some faction, and probably to some degree in the donor faction, that says, you know what, that's not really where I want to put my money. That's not really what's most important to me. So you haven't seen the same kind of energy and coordination on the conservative side around winning this race than you're seeing on the progressive side, which is unusual for a down ballot race. Well, that mean is that going to answer who's going to win? I can't say it definitively, but it's certainly a hopeful sign for Democrats going into Tuesday.
I'm anxious to see what happens in the Supreme Court. There's also a state Senate seat up that could give Republicans supermajority status, which could override the governor, and also maybe throw some elected Democrats out. How do you see that race going?
I don't know enough about that particular district to be able to give you a really strong sense of which way it's going to tip. But certainly, if there is more turnout happening on the Democratic side because of the statewide race,
yeah,
that might have some spillover effect into the state Senate race.
Well, we'll see how that plays out. But Bill, as always, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. Good stuff.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
You as well. Our good friend, Bill Scheer. Make sure you check out the work that he does. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, President Biden was out on the road today. And look, this is important stuff. Getting the president out on the road talking about the bills that they've gotten through, the investments that they're doing. He tweeted out, "We're building a future where you won't have to leave your hometown to find a good job. You can raise a family on. It's all part of my agenda to invest in America, American jobs, and innovation. Pride in our country," he says. "Dignity for workers and their families." The president was at the Cummins facility in Freedley, Minnesota, and discussing how his economic agenda has led really to the strong job growth and the idea that, look, we're investing in manufacturing, something we haven't done in decades. But he was at this facility, the Cummings Power Generation facility. The visit was part of the tour that he started last week, the Investing in America tour, promoting the fact that his economic agenda is working. We are creating jobs, and those jobs are good family-sustaining jobs. Now, Cummings, they manufacture generators and other power generation equipment. They announced last October, if you remember, that they were going to start manufacturing these electrolyzers. And I guess it's the first time in the history of the country we've done this, because I guess what it does is it takes clean hydrogen, is what they're saying. I don't know, but they're taking hydrogen and they're using it for to create energy, to produce, you know, hydrogen fuel, to another energy supply. We'll see where this goes. He does point out that there's been more than $2 billion in private sector investment into Minnesota because of what the administration has done. They've also pointed out that there's been, now again, this is the green energy stuff. Remember, you got the XL Energy plant there, which is a $575 million, 450-megawatt solar project. You've got another solar panel construction as well going on. Bobcat's got some new assembly going on. There's some manufacturing, some jobs coming back. Also, he points out that there are 182 infrastructure projects across the state, $2.7 billion in federal funding. Now, here's the thing. This is where I go, you know, we need to be doing more of this. Last week they were out. They need to be out every day. They need to be front and center and doing these stops, talking about all of the manufacturing that's coming back because of our policies. Because if you listen to Republicans, the economy's terrible, everything's horrible, the sky's falling, we're all going to be out on the street corners with pencils, tin cups and pencils begging. When the reality is we've got decades of cleaning up to do, decades of bad policy. And look, Biden was part of that bad policy. The fact that he's the guy who said, you know, it didn't work and we're turning the corner, important. But I don't ignore the fact that he was part of a lot of this stuff. This is where Republicans go, wow, you know, Joe Biden did this. Okay, he's now undoing it. That's the important part. We're now moving in a direction to start reshoring some of our supply chains. And the pandemic had a big part of this. I've been talking about reshoring manufacturing for the last 18 years, saying, look, we need to have jobs for working people. And this is where I go back to the conversation about automation. I don't want these factories to come back and all we get is the pollution and not the jobs that come with it, where we end up having these huge warehouses where it's all done by robots. I want people to have good jobs, good union jobs, with good health care and good retirement security. Now, I have got friends who are like, well, you know, those days are gone, Rick. You know, this is the new era. You know, big tech is going to control everything. And that may be. And this is where we as working people have to be, you know, reaching out to our elected officials and getting them on this issue. You know, all they keep hearing about and all they keep getting, you know, suckered into is all of this other stuff. All this stuff that doesn't mean anything and how you put food on the table. We need to get them moving in a direction that's doing the things that need to get done. And if we're not going to slow down the AI, if we're not going to look, I've said I'm not against automated trucks on the road. But every person who's in the industry should be red circled and they should be paid their salary throughout the remainder of their careers. Yes, we're going to make it more expensive to move over to tech stuff. Yes, but it's not going to be done on the chins of working people. You're going to make those folks whole. We want innovation. We want advancement. But it's not going to be at the expense of working families. It's not going to be at the expense of you and me and the people who get up every day and are told if you work hard, play by the rules, you'll get ahead, only to find out that they're getting kicked in the teeth day after day. This is where we need a political system of us taking control of it. Instead of being fed this outrage candy and this stuff that's meant to tear us apart. So for me, we've got a lot of work to do. quite frankly. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And the sooner we get around to it, I think the better off we're going to be. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with our good friend Bob Nay. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the night that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his now famous I've Been to the Mountaintop speech at the Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. He was speaking in support of striking sanitation workers who were members of AFSCME Local 1733. During his speech, he said, "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't really matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and He's allowed me to go up to the mountaintop, and I've looked over, and I've been to the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land." The next day, Dr. King was murdered by an assassin's bullet at the Lorraine Motel. In 2015, AFSCME President Lee Saunders wrote about the importance of remembering Dr. King's legacy to today's labor movement. Let's honor Dr. King by taking a page out of his playbook. Let's give workers the power to reshape our struggling economy and improve the lives of all Americans by negotiating better wages and benefits. Yes, unions are still the answer, the path to the middle class, for every American and not just African Americans. We follow Dr. King's path. We pursue his dream by organizing. It is the way forward for our union and the nation.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
With new outrages erupting every day, I find some comfort in knowing that we the people have at least eliminated certain particularly ugly plutocratic abuses. Child labor, for example. Well, outlawed, yes. Stopped, no. Recent reports reveal that thousands of children ages 12 to 17 are toiling illegally at dangerous jobs in manufacturing, construction, food processing, etc. To be clear, there's nothing wrong with teenagers working. They might need to help their families, gain experience, or just earn a few bucks. Indeed, I worked part-time throughout my high school and college years, and while I did gripe some, overall, it was positive. So this is not about children working. It's about corporate child abuse, plain and simple. For example, last year, Packer Sanitation Services was caught, quote, employing oppressive child labor in meatpacking plants to clean saws, head splitters, and other butchering machines. In a typical incident, one 13-year-old was badly burned by the caustic cleaning chemicals they used during long night shifts, which ran from 11 p.m. to at least 5 a.m. Once caught, top executives of Packer Sanitation tried to sanitize their reputation by proclaiming that they have, quote, zero tolerance for any violation of child labor laws. Oh? Ask that 13-year-old. Yet, our worker protection laws are so weak that Packer's multiple violations resulted in a fine of $1.5 million. That's not even peanuts for this nationwide giant, which is owned by Blackstone, a Wall Street huckster whose executives pretend they know nothing about the children they endanger for profit. This is Jim Hightower saying, how about we make a few of the children and grandchildren of Blackstone profiteers work some midnight shifts cleaning meat-cutting machinery? I'm guessing they would stop the abuse overnight.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So looking forward to Tuesday. Going to see what happens in New York. And I know there's a lot of chatter of who knows. You've got Marjorie Three Names down there who's claiming that the mayor has threatened her. And again, you know, just trying to stir up the chaos. But here to share some thoughts on maybe how tomorrow's going to go. Because, again, unprecedented. I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
So what do we think is going to happen tomorrow? Are we expecting a lot of people? Are we expecting, you know, rocks thrown? Will Trump punch a cop, as Lindsey Graham said to do?
No, I don't think he will. You're not going to see, I can't imagine where Trump will look dejected, where he's like down, et cetera. I think you'll probably see a smiling Trump waving, et cetera. Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene will get, some attention because she's Marjorie Taylor Greene. But in general, I just don't believe there'll be violence. There can be violence anywhere, anytime there's a protest. I just don't think you're going to see it.
Yeah.
The reaction right now by a lot of people is like, okay,
I think a lot of people are in the place that I'm in, which is I want to see what the indictment is. I want to see what he's being charged with. Okay, let's see. There are 34 felonies. There's one charge of hushing up a porn star. How is it? How'd you get to 34 felonies? That's what I want to see.
Well, now I can tell you a little bit about that. Although this is not the Fed, but my lawyers told me at the time, because at one point in time I was going to go to trial, I hired former DOJ people, because that's what you do. You hire people that used to prosecute people, right?
Right.
And then they commented to me on what they thought that, that the government case would be weak because of other people like Tom DeLay, et cetera, that weren't charged. And they reviewed all that. And then they said, look, if you go into court, of course, I needed $3.2 million. But if I went into court, into a trial, they said, my lawyers told me I would be charged with about 65 counts.
Wow.
I pled to do 65, and I'm like, what are those? And then my lawyer starts spitting out things, the way you look, the way you breathe, the way when the government goes at Blagojevich, remember? What did he have, 60-some counts?
It was obscene.
So anytime this happens with basically anybody from the Fed end, at least, they go in for the throat kill, And then they hope what happened with Blagojevich. I think if I'm right, he might have had 64 counts. I forget. He beat all of them. Mistrial, then he beat all of them except one. And then when the one count came, he got 14 years. So that's what I think the prosecutors do, everything under the sun that they can do. So that's why I think you're going to see so many of them. And then there'll be misdemeanors, here. Judge himself ruled no TV cameras.
Yeah, which I got to tell you, I think is wrong. I think this is something that we need to see.
Right. I am shocked that he ruled that there would be no cameras, in the courtroom. Now, I know this is going to be difficult. Trump's own lawyer was upset about, some of the things he was saying about the prosecutor. They did they're going to do what I thought they would do. They're going to try to get a change of venue. In my case, for example, we were going to try to go to Ohio, and the government didn't want us in Ohio. There were reasons we wanted to go to Ohio,
sure.
Obviously. Government didn't want us in Ohio. They wanted us in D.C. Trump's case, he's going to argue, he can't get a fair trial. And he said he has said all these things, about the judge, about the judge hates him, about the prosecutor. So normally people can say things and it's like, oh, okay, but this I think one thing, Rick, I think we have to keep in mind, and it goes to your point about the cameras, this is unique. They should allow cameras, particularly in this case in the courtroom, because for either side, it's a precedent setting. It's not like, you know, you want to keep it hush-hush what happened. They're going to report on it anyway, right? But as far as what Trump's going to argue, this is, again, quite a unique case. I mean, if I was his lawyer, I'd argue that, you know, he can't get a fair trial there. Of course I'd make that argument.
Yeah, I'd make the argument he can't get a fair trial anywhere.
That's true. Like I said, jury selection. Who'd you vote for? Have you or your cousins or your cousins' neighbors ever contributed, you know, to Joe Biden or the Democrat Party?
Yeah.
I mean, no. There's going to be all kinds of things.
And the other side, you own a MAGA hat, you know, because again, you know, maybe the best outcome is you get a MAGA jury, and if your evidence is there, you know, maybe that's the only way they could convict. But then again, look, you know, with where we're at, I don't. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, what I do find interesting is no mugshot. I was expecting like a Tom DeLay kind of mugshot, mm-hmm. but evidently no mugshot.
Well, they're going to take a mugshot. There's going to be a standard photo. I just don't think they're going to release it.
All right, because the report I saw said, yep, no mugshot, no handcuffs, no jail, none of that.
Well, no, none of that. But I saw a report of no mugshot. I saw that, but I think, I could be extremely wrong, there's going to be a mugshot. It just won't be particularly made public. Now, the handcuff thing, and I think I said this on your show last week, I asked my lawyers, you know, about the handcuffs because in the Casino Jack movie, they show me coming out of my office in handcuffs, which never happened. And I asked my lawyers, how come I'm not getting handcuffed? And they said, well, the government's worried it would get you some sympathy. I'm like, really? And they go, yeah, they're not going to put you in a jumpsuit and they're not going to handcuff you. And when I was taken down to the District of Columbia, and then eventually to the Justice Department, when I was taking District Columbia, they had, I was never put around other people. When I was in the federal courtroom, I was not put, you know, when I was fingerprinted and things, I wasn't put around other people. That did not happen. I think they worry, you know, you get hurt, and then, of course, somebody looks into that and what happened. So that's the process. Now, the judge can say, give me your passport. I highly doubt he does that. So there'll be some routine things, Rick, and some non-routine things.
Yeah, because this is
obviously
not routine.
Secret Service is there.
This is not routine. I mean,
right.
You don't go go indicting a former president very often. Mm-hmm. We'll see. Again, I'm interested to see what happens, especially with Marjorie Three Names there stirring up trouble. Did you see her interview on 60 Minutes?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, you didn't miss anything. Neither did many other people.
I didn't. No, I didn't see it. I didn't actually even know about it. And I keep pace with things that one I didn't know about.
Yeah, Leslie Stahl did
that. If I was Trump's lawyer, I probably wouldn't want her there. Because we have to remember something. Trump's lawyer is a lawyer. And I'm sure he doesn't want her there, but there's nothing you can't tell her to stay away. You know, she wants the publicity of being there and probably will throw a fundraiser because she's supporting Donald Trump. Send me some money.
No, that's the key through all of this. Send me money.
Well, Trump raised, what, $5 million
yeah.
this week?
In the 48 hours after the indictment, yep. And you knew that
right.
was going to happen.
Right.
I love the video, though. I don't need your money. I can't be bought. But, oh, by the way, send me money.
Right. Well, this is a process. And as I tell people that have asked me about it, it isn't routine. You're correct. But then there's the whole trial process where, you know, there's appeals. And how long will this take? If you're Trump, do you want this to take longer, or do you want it to wrap up? I mean, which do you want? You
know? I guess it depends on how much evidence they have.
Right. Right.
I mean, if there's evidence, you might want to draw this out. If you think you can win this, you might want to get this out of the way so you can say, look, I'm the Teflon Don. They couldn't get me. And then, you know, set the tone for the other ones.
Right. I mean, the polls are showing that, you know, this is not helpful to him. But if he is acquitted, that sort of cements him on the Republican side. Because prior to this, and, you know, I made a prediction, never thought about this part happening, but, you know, he would not be in the convention as a candidate. And right before all of this happened, you know, DeSantis was edging up in the polls. Trump was losing some steam. You know, his big rally wasn't the what they thought it would be, et cetera. And then this happened, and it changes, you know, the dynamic.
Yeah, see, because my mind is along with your friend Mustache. You know, John Bolton said, I'm not worried about Alvin Bragg hurting Donald Trump. I'm worried about Alvin Bragg benefiting Donald Trump if Trump is acquitted or gets this case dismissed because it's not legally sufficient. That will be rocket fuel because he can say, I told you this was a political prosecution, and I don't disagree with him.
Right, and then it also makes, and people will say, well, you know, the courts don't act this way. Yes, they do. This would give a certain amount of chill to a prosecutor in Georgia, and I'll tell you why. Doesn't mean they won't indict in Georgia, but a prosecutor has to sit there and they have one thought in mind: can they win a case?
Yep.
You don't take a case against Donald Trump and you'd lose. You don't do that. So if he wins this, if he's acquitted, it's thrown out, mistrial, whatever happens, it has to have a bearing on the thinking in other cases. Because the feds under Garland did not bring a case against Trump, you know, on these issues. They didn't do it. Of course, they're a little gun shy from the John Edwards days, you know, with the case.
Yeah, you remember when hush money was a crime in Republican eyes?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, John Edwards.
Remember that? You know, Sean Hannity, this is a crime. Yeah.
Right, right.
I remember those days.
John Edwards was acquitted.
And look, you know, the reality is, you know, I was even saying back then, you know, John Edwards, what are you doing?
Right.
Moron? And I wanted him to be president. Thank goodness he didn't get the nomination. I do want to get your thoughts on what's going on in Tennessee. I want to change gears a little bit because this is as I predicted when they threw Marjorie Trainwreck off of her committee. This is now going to be standard operating procedure. It looks like the Republicans in Tennessee in the state house there are kicking three Democrats off of their committees and out completely, as it looks like, because they had the audacity to protest against gun violence in the House. Any thoughts on that?
Right. The Tennessee, they're beginning the expulsion process is what they're doing for three Democrats. And it's going to, you know, it's going to put the whole place into an upheaval. They introduced legislation to expel three Democrats for, quote, disorderly behavior. Now, that's after the three led protest chants for gun reform on the floor of the chamber, you know, and that was in wake of the Covenant shooting. Three of the Democrats went to the podium, and between bills, now they weren't recognized to speak, which is a breach of chamber rules, okay? Fine, it is. And with a bullhorn, the reps led protests in the gallery of the House and chants calling for gun reform. Now, this is kind of interesting because the House leadership, GOP leadership, said that their behavior was like insurrection, which...
yeah, they're exactly the same.
Didn't mind in one case, you know. They didn't mind. Now, here's the thing. The bottom line is, whoever they are, they've broke protocol. They shouldn't do that. There's rules in the U.S. House, you know, for protocol, where if you say certain things, your words are taken down, which happened to John Micah from Florida, including Republicans voting to take his words down. There's certain protocol during sessions. So these three broke the protocol. Now, to expel them, they're not taking them out of the committee. They're trying to expel them.
Right.
And to expel them is like, you know, somebody cusses at you and you try to give them life in prison without parole. It's I can't imagine how an expulsion will be approved by the legislature. I can't imagine. But I've said this, and you and I talked about this on your show. I was when the Democrats were controlling the House and were throwing people off committees, you know, and for this and for that. Then the Republicans did it, you know, for this and for that. Now the state legislature is doing it because they violated the rules of the House. And again, this is like a death sentence they're trying to institute on these three. They shouldn't have done it. They should, you know, take their words down or condemn them for what they did or, you know, fine them if they have a fine process or something. But my goodness, to expel them? That's ridiculous.
But this was predictable. And look, I hate to, you know, go back to that day, mm-hmm. You know, back then when the Democrats were going, you know, and look, there was a reason to throw Marjorie three names off. You just don't do it. And as I said before, you know, I wanted her on those committees so you could turn to her and go, you know, we need more education funding. There she is, Exhibit A. But you knew this was going to get to the end of this road, which is, you know, there's no shame on a lot of these with a lot of these folks, and you knew this was what was going to come.
Right, right. And then in Tennessee, they stripped them of their garage pass.
Yeah.
The badge of the building was cut off, and I think one of the members has a scooter. He has a mobility issue or something. I don't know, but anyway, that was inside the building, and he couldn't get it, and he needed to go home, you know, or use it, and he was going to go home for the weekend. So, when you see this, you're like, wow, you know, just condemn them, have a vote, tell them about their behavior. You know, et cetera. Now, the last time they expelled a sitting member was in 2016, and that was a 70-2 vote, by the way, in Tennessee to remove Representative Durham. He was a Republican, but that was for sexual misconduct. And that was the first expulsion since 1980 and only the second since the Civil War. So they would be expelling, I mean, almost history-setting expulsions for non-committal of a crime. You know, these three didn't commit a crime. Might have been bad protocol.
No, it was a crime. It was a crime, Bob. It was a crime. They were talking bad about guns.
In
Tennessee, if you talk bad about guns, that's a crime because remember the reason that they were screaming and hollering. Mm-hmm. You know, they're loosening gun restrictions. You're going to do nothing. Over the fact that you've got more murdered children. You had those, you know, 3 9-year-olds being executed. And all we hear about is the shooter. And you go, well, wait a second. This is a great opportunity to start talking about red flag laws. This is the perfect case to start talking about that.
Well, red flag laws might as well be called green flag laws. You're 100% right. They have to start addressing, you know, those issues, and red flag laws have to start being able to, you know, be something that actually works.
Yeah, no,
and they need to dig into it.
Now we'll see where this goes, but nothing good comes of this. Nothing good.
No.
Bob, as always, appreciate the time.
I don't think they'll expel them.
What was that?
I don't think they'll expel them.
Well, we'll
see.
Well, this is, again, more fun and entertainment for tomorrow and the day after.
Exactly.
But as always, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2008. At 8:48 in the morning, America Transair Flight 4586 touched down in Phoenix, Arizona. The flight had been delayed 2 hours before taking off in Honolulu. As the passengers departed the plane, few likely realized that they would be the last passengers ever to fly ATA. The company had filed bankruptcy and closed its doors. Thousands of passengers holding ATA tickets had to scramble to make new travel plans. More than 2,000 workers were out of a job. ATA had already filed bankruptcy 3 years earlier. They emerged from bankruptcy briefly. When an expected contract to fly charter flights for military personnel fell through, the airline could not weather the storm. At its peak, ATA was the 10th largest airline in the United States. Its story was not unique. As many airlines went through bankruptcy since the dawn of the new century, the airlines have used actual bankruptcies and threatened bankruptcies to gain drastic concessions from their unionized workers. As part of the bankruptcy process, these airlines have laid off tens of thousands of employees, slashed pensions, and rolled back benefits. The mantra from management was that to get through these tough times, there would have to be shared sacrifice. Yet, not everyone was asked to share in that sacrifice. In 2003, American Airlines threatened bankruptcy to win $1.8 billion in concessions on wages and benefits from the three labor unions representing Americans' workers. But while workers sacrificed, top management continued to enjoy millions in retention bonuses and golden parachutes. In total, between 2001 and 2010, nearly 200,000 airline workers lost their jobs, and workers made $12 billion in concessions on wages and benefits. Yet by 2011, the average U.S. airline CEO had seen their compensation soar to more than $3.5 million. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. No, I look at this Tennessee thing, and again, it's all over this this mass shooting. And again, you know, I guess you have to give, you know, Tennessee Republicans credit that they're more interested in punishing Democrats and doing nothing than they are in actually fixing the problem. And look, they did come out and we're honest. We're not going to do anything because their mindset is, well, you're bad people out there. And even if you're in the mindset of, okay, well, more guns solve the problem, we should have armed guards at every school. Why don't we then? And this is the part that gets me. If this is what you believe, then why aren't you pushing for that? Why aren't we funding that? Why aren't we moving in that direction? Other than just going, oh, thoughts and prayers. I mean, we didn't even get the thoughts and prayers this time around. And the next time we won't. So, I mean, I see Ted Cruz losing his mind. And, you know, you remember him when Uvalde happened? Oh, well, the school has too many doors and windows. We need a, you know, one door, no windows. We're gonna lock our kids down into camps and surround them with barbed wire and armed guards. And that's the only way we can keep them safe, all because we don't want to deal with the real issue is. The real issue is the ease and the availability of weapons of war. And look, I'm not a gun grabber. I've said a million times, I've got one in arm's reach. This is not about that. This is about making sure that, in this case especially, that there are precautions in place. That we're checking who's got what. And I know that we have this strange idea that we have this unfettered right to every weapon. I actually had a conversation with a guy not too long ago who told me he believes there should be absolutely no gun control. And I'm going, no, we've got gun control. We've got gun control. It's just a matter of where we're drawing the line. You can't have a fully automatic weapon. You can't have, you know, go down the list of other military armament. If the goal really was by the founders and the Supreme Court, you know, to water the tree of liberty with the blood of tyrants and patriots, we could have nuclear weapons. We could have, you know, missiles, and we could have all this stuff if you could afford it. But we don't, because everyone just about believes in some type of gun control. It's a matter of where we draw the line. And just because somebody's inconvenienced, because we have to make sure that maybe you're not having a lot of problems, maybe you're not running from, you know, some protection of abuse order. Maybe you're not doing some things just because you're inconvenienced. Sorry, that doesn't mean that our kids should be locked down. But maybe it does. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, especially the angry, evil ones. Those usually go to the top of the heap. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And for the good folks in Santa Fe, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.